That's a you have a wonderful a library of people and wonderful people that you invite and feel welcome on your show. It really is terrific. I appreciate being here.
Well, we're so excited to have you on with us. You have had such a remarkable career, and am I correct that maybe we go back to your childhood and the fact that you won a poetry contest? Was that the inspiration that got you started?
Well, I think the moment I got out of the womb, I reached for a pencil. I wasn't reaching for a hand or anything like that. I was reaching for a pencil. But I think I knew early on that I wanted to write something, and I wanted to get paid for writing. I thought, my father always said, "You're not really working unless you get paid for what you do." And so I tried to write greeting cards first. And I actually sold one for about 20 bucks, and I sold a greeting card when I was a young kid. But then I got into writing poetry, and you're absolutely right. You bring back a memory. There was a poetry contest, a yearly anthology of poetry and poetry contests for schools in New York City. And I came in as one of the top winners. So I was published in this book, an anthology of poetry, and my poem was called Man. And it was like a 13-year-old trying to describe what humanity was all about. I think I was a little precocious at that time. I hope that's not the same with my new book, Black Sun.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that. It sounds like a fascinating story here, a lot going on, working in with AI and everything else. Tell us all about it.
Well, it's very kind of you. It's been a kind of subject that's fascinated me for my entire life. I went from writing poetry, as you brought up, and then I got into college. I got a scholarship for playwriting, so I went to Carnegie Mellon, and as the undergraduate drama department, and it's one of the best in the country, and I
I was
got a
thinking,
scholarship.
were you there about the same time as a friend of our show, Michael McKeon?
Oh. Michael McKean and David Lander, Iggy, Squiggy,
Right, Lenny and Squiggy.
and the two of them, they were, yes, I was a year ahead of them, but yes, we were there at the same time. We were friends for years thereafter. So yes, it was a great class that I came from, and so I was there to study playwriting. And I came out of there, and then I started writing right away. I got the job writing as soon as I got out of college. I got a job writing, and I started in advertising first, movie advertising, and I moved my way up. But as I began to write, and I sold my first screenplay, and which was called Electric Light and Blue.
Oh, love the movie. Love it. One of my favorites.
Oh wow, that's really nice. It remains as a kind of cult. A biker movie classic, and Bobby Blake was just absolutely wonderful as the short, overachieving motorcycle cop. And so I wrote that, it was the first script I wrote, and it became a feature film from a major studio, which was very rare. And what always fascinated me was adventure. And I loved big movies. I loved telling tales that were larger than life. So I started writing things about military interactions and giant, my versions of Lawrence of Arabia. Basically, I was a young man trying to do Lawrence of Arabia. I was so caught up with that movie and the scope and the scale of it that I wanted to write big adventure. One of the first screenplays that I wrote, which I sold to a guy named Ridley Scott, who I'm sure you know. And I wrote the first draft of Air Force One. So I became friends with people in the military. And when I was doing that, I started to be fascinated by planes. So during the recent Writers Guild strike, I had started to write a screenplay about, my friends in the Air Force told me about the newest generation of super planes that were coming out and super bombers. That were the most incredible aircraft and weapons of war that you could ever imagine. They could do everything but tie your shoelaces. And they were just incredible. So I started to tell a story about that. I thought that would be a great, you know, why not during the course of the strike, you know, I was starting to write a screenplay, but then I realized the strike was going to go on for a long time, and I could not talk to anybody because I'm a member of the WGA, but I was also an award-winning writer for TV miniseries. So I would never cross and never, you know, not follow WGA guidelines. So I couldn't talk to anybody about a screenplay. So I decided to go back to writing a novel. So I started writing this novel about a seizing and the hijacking of this incredible airplane. I thought, well, that's a terrific, you know, idea for a novel. And so I thought it would be great. And I started to write it. And I suddenly began to realize as I was writing that the world was only talking about two things. Every day on the news, every day on TV, they were only talking about two things. One was Donald Trump, and the other was artificial intelligence. And I suddenly realized if a plane is going to be so incredible and with so many different systems working at the same time, 38,000 systems functioning at the same time. Imagine that, Rich. And I said, well, it can only have the most advanced artificial intelligence ever created. If it's the best plane ever created, it's got to be have the most advanced artificial intelligence. So I suddenly realized as the bad guys were trying to seize the plane and there was a activity on board the plane, I suddenly realized that if it was going to be stopped and halted, it would be a connection between our hero, who is the in charge of security, an ex-Navy SEAL, working in conjunction with the artificial intelligence. And at the end of that, after they beat the guys and they took over and held control of the plane, I realized I was on about page 50. So what do I do with the rest of my story? I was like, well, the book is over, the movie is over. What are you going to do? And I suddenly decided, you know what? I realized that the artificial intelligence would say, my protocol is to protect this plane at all costs. Therefore, I now realize that human beings are incapable of protecting this aircraft. So I'm going to seize control of this aircraft and take over and make sure that it's safe. And when the Pentagon goes, what the hell is going on up there? And they send up a couple of Raptors and F-22s to investigate the plane and look at over the plane as it's flying and on its shakedown cruise, the artificial intelligence reads the planes as hostile, and because its systems are so incredible, blows our own planes out of the sky. And suddenly we have our story of the most powerful plane and the most powerful force of intelligence ever assembled, in essence, threatening the entire world. And that's what I wrote when I decided to write Black Sun.
Wow, it sounds fabulous. And I have to think it's just the nature of your writing style, because you've written so many plays, so many screenplays, that this it already has a cinematic feel as you describe it.
You know, when I grew up as a kid, I was in love with the radio, okay? I used to hide under the pillow, under the covers at night, and my mother was
Who knows
moving
what
around it,
evil lurks in the hearts of men?
or under the blankets of children, right? So I was under the blanket and I was listening to the radio, and I loved theater of the mind. And I began to realize as I was writing, you are 100% correct, Rich. You're on the money. I realized that I write in a kind of cinematic style. I'm writing kind of for a movie of an IMAX for the brain, that I try to create stories that you can see, you can visualize what I'm talking about, and you can see it in the sense of a progressive drama, the way you would in a movie that you're really involved in. And I'm writing movies for the brain in a way that is a thriller, that is always a surprise every few minutes, that there are characters that are memorable. That's what I try to do. I've used, you know, 50 years of experience in writing to try and turn that into a book that makes it eminently readable.
We're talking with Robert Boris here on Downtown. His new book is called Black Sun. I want to go back in time a little bit and talk about a guy who's played a big role in your career, Elliot Kastner. How did you guys come into each other's orbits? And is the story true that he nearly had Richard Dreyfuss and Roy Scheider for your first film, but decided to aim for, well, let's use the term, bigger fish?
You are one hell of a detective, Richard. I don't know how you knew, found that one out, but yes, it's true. I guess when I started to write, because I had this experience of my first screenplay being turned into a feature film by United Artists. That doesn't happen. So I came out to L.A. And I met, I was interviewed by a guy named Charles Champlain, that he was the columnist for the LA Times. And he interviewed me because it was an unusual story of a writer, you know, coming fresh out of college and having a feature film. So it got into the press, and somehow Elliot Kastner got a hold of me. Now, Elliot was a remarkable filmmaker. He had done things that I loved. I mean, he produced some amazing films. He also produced some terrible films, but most of his work was remarkable. And he did Harper with Paul Newman, and which I loved. It was a private eye movie. It was one of the best private eye movies ever made. And so he had done that. And he also did Where Eagles Dare. You know, an incredible, I guess maybe the first great buddy movie with superstars, you know, Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood. And it's a great, great adventure thriller. So I had met Elliot, and he wanted to meet with me and talk about what to do and what we could possibly do together. And we became, I was just, it was the early days. This was Hollywood of the 70s. It was a wonderful time for movie making, and he wanted to make all kinds of films, and we started to talk, and he said, what are you working on now? And I said, well, the last job that I had, I was in advertising, and I went to do, I wrote commercials, so I went to do a commercial in a place called the Four Corners. I think it's the only place in the United States where four states actually touch each other. And when I was there, they were talking about an Indian uprising that took place. It was the very last Indian uprising. It took place right in that area, and it happened in 1915. And I went, are you kidding me? There was an Indian uprising in 1915? So I went to research it. And when everybody went back to Madison Avenue and back to New York from where we were in Denver, I guess, and everybody went back, I stayed to research and talk to some people. And I found out that there really was this Indian uprising, that what happened was Indians, they tried to seize the territory because the Homestead Act had been passed. And people, if you lived on a certain area of property for a while, you became the owner of it. And so these Indians now owned land that had great mineral rights. And of course, there were business forces that wanted to remove them. So it was very hostile and very ugly. And when certain Indians who lived off the reservation, they were called digger Indians because they lived off of the scrub roots they dug in the ground. So when they refused to be herded back onto a reservation, they put up a resistance. People came and killed some of them, and then before any more could happen, all the Indians on that reservation moved off the reservation and went to protect this group that they didn't like anyway, because they were kind of like, they didn't want any part of the reservation, so they didn't like them, but they didn't want to see anybody else massacred or killed, so they moved off. And it so happens that we were starting to bivouac and do military games with our newest military forces in those days, in 1915. So you're talking about armed soldiers with tanks and howitzers and all that stuff. And now they were, since they were there in the area, they were asked to go and to herd these Indians back onto the reservation. And the idea of a showdown between modern mechanized troops and against a bunch of Indians that barely had enough to food to eat, it was to me remarkable, and it struck Eliot. And Eliot said, "I want that script." And I loved him for that. And so I wrote the script. It was called The Day the Indians Beat St. Louis, because there was an Indian who got into a lot of trouble, and they actually picked him up and held him for trial, and the trial was moved to St. Louis. So I told his story. And Eliot said, "You know what? I had spoken to Richard Dreyfuss, who was just fresh out of Jaws, and Scheider. And they want to play, Scheider wants to play the Indian, and Richard Dreyfuss wants to play the reporter." And I went, "Oh my God, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened." And I was thrilled beyond belief. I was so excited. And then he said, "But I can do better."
Well, and he threw out a couple of big names, right?
Oh, he threw out Brando and Nicholson, you
Yeah,
know,
there you go.
so not exactly, mashed potatoes, So I was thrilled beyond belief, but I go like, "Wait a minute, you're gonna get rid of, you're gonna not go with Scheider and Dreyfuss in the biggest movie ever made, and you want to go after Brando and Nicholson?" And he said, "Yeah, I'll get them. Don't worry about it. I know Brando. I can take care of it." Of course, it didn't happen. He ultimately made a movie with Brando and Nicholson. That was which
Missouri
one?
Breaks, right?
That's the one. Yeah, very good.
Yeah.
Missouri Breaks. Yeah. So he made Missouri Breaks. And but it's a true story. But I remained very close to Elliot and his son, Cassian Ellis. We all became friends. And when Elliot said to me one day, "I have some money." It was the days when you couldn't take the money you made in a foreign country. If you made a movie there, you couldn't take it out of the country and bring it back, into your own bank account back in the States or whatever. And he said, "I have about $1.5 million or $2 million that I have to spend in England. What have you got?"
Oxford
And
Blues.
I thought as fast as I could, and I came up with Oxford Blues. And he said, "How fast can you write that?" And I said, "Well, what time is it?" And so I went to work on the script with him, and he was a wonderful producer. He knew what story was. He knew what he liked. And his son Cassian, who was starting to become a filmmaker on his own right, became the producer of it. And we put it together, and we suddenly had Oxford Blues, and I got my chance to direct my first movie.
Which is
So I
it's a wonderful, I think, underappreciated film. I think an underrated performance by Rob Lowe, and you worked with him later on Frank and Jesse. I feel like Rob is one of those guys that doesn't get enough credit because he still looks so damn good that people just assume he's a pretty boy and can't act.
He is amazing, and he I think Oxford Blues was a fun role, and I enjoyed that very much. But I think what he did in Frank and Jesse, I think, is wonderful. I looked at it again. I'll tell you one little story. I don't mean to digress, but I'll tell you one little story which I think I'll never forget. The camera, I think the look of Oxford Blues shooting at that incredible on those grounds
Because you got to
was just.
shoot at Oxford, right?
I lived at Oxford
Yeah.
for it was 3 or 4 weeks, and shot everything there, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was absolutely wonderful, and it was like having this incredible set. I mean, you couldn't turn the camera in a bad direction. There is no bad angle at Oxford. It's just one shot after another. It's just remarkable. But I had the camera operator was a guy named Chick Waterson, and I'll give you this very little brief story. Chick Waterson was the camera operator, and he had operated on Lawrence of Arabia. He had operated on so many big pictures. He was really a great English operator. And I said, one time while we were shooting, and he helped me design a shot, and I said, "What is it that you love about this? And you approach your work with so much love and affection, and no matter what the shot is, no matter how small or how big, what is it you love about it?" And he said, and I'll never forget this, and it's a lesson. He said, "The reason I love it is because I'm the first one who ever sees the movie."
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that
Wow.
beautiful? I mean, that stuck with me forever, Rich. It really, this was getting a chance to work with Elliot, to work with Cassian, to work on that film was terrific. And then of course, it all led, all of these things led me to meeting Ridley Scott, where I started to write Air Force One, which ultimately led me to Black Sun, which is what actually finally happened was I'm sitting there and I was starting to work on the book, and I had written a novel about 30 years earlier. I hadn't written gone back to a novel in a long time. I wrote a novel called Blood Feud, which became a miniseries that also starred Robert Blake, and it was about the Kennedy administration and their war on organized crime. So I'm sitting there deciding about what I'm going to do and what I'm going to write, and I'm working on Black Sun. And then I start to piece together when I had the idea about that the artificial intelligence becomes a character and becomes a part of this, instead of just being like this malevolent force. The role model in some ways, I know you know the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey.
I thought of Hal immediately as you were describing it.
And that's precisely correct. What I had in mind was a kind of modern, updated version of Hal the computer, because Hal the computer actually kills one of the astronauts. So I had in mind the same idea, but I wanted to create more of a character. And as I'm starting to think about it, I sat down and I began to write in my head. I began to visualize something, and I thought, okay, what about here's how my thinking went. And so I said, if the most advanced AI unit ever created by science seizes the deadliest warplane ever built by man, then threatens the entire world and the future of mankind, Black Sun is that story. Black Sun is a nonstop, relentless action thriller, a page turner that grips with really icy fingers and doesn't let you go. It's a kind of white knuckle ride into pure hell. And that reveals the most important question of our time, which is, has man finally created the Frankenstein monster of his own undoing?
Wow.
And I suddenly realized that it was more than just a thriller and an action thriller, which is what it is, with a lot of surprises and twists and turns and global politics. With all of that, it really asks a much more serious question as to what is the role, and because people are afraid of what AI can do. And there are, I've been doing research, there have been tons of letters being written by scientists all over the world who are begging nations start to set some limitations for artificial intelligence.
Well, there are some big moral, ethical questions there.
There are huge questions, and the reason I did what I did with the book is that I remembered growing up as a kid that I loved, absolutely loved all the monster movies that we saw as kids. Now, why do those movies, especially Frankenstein, which Mary Shelley wrote in the 1890s, and then they did in the 30s, James Whale directed the first one in the 1930s, early 30s. Why has there been hundreds and literally hundreds of versions of Frankenstein retold and retold over and over and over again? Why was that so successful? And why does that character still in many people's nightmares and dreams? And it's because they were very smart back then, and what they did was they make the character of the monster not just a killer and a malevolent force, but they made him almost empathetic, almost trying to be human, and having even a little bit of a dream. And I realized if I can make this character in Black Sun, which is my Adam, which is my artificial intelligence, make you at times sympathize with him and make him actually see him learning, because artificial intelligence, the whole thing behind it, is that it constantly evolves, it keeps learning. It learns more from its mistakes than it learns from its successes. And so it is a force to reckon with. And so I thought, if I could create a character here that is unforgettable and empathetic, that you see why he's doing what he's doing, maybe then you have something that you really can relate to. It's not just an evil force, but it's the human being you have empathy with. All the monsters that are really successful do exactly that.
Well, and as you
Why do you?
explained it, he's doing what he was built to do, which is to preserve that plane.
That's right, and he takes it on in that protocol on steroids, and goes beyond what it's supposed to designed to do. And so I began to think that once you I think let me go back to one other thing, that what they did on the second Frankenstein movie, James Whale then, because it was so successful, made what was called The Bride of Frankenstein. Now that's a truly visual, fantastical journey. They have little people living inside tubes. They do all kinds of things that are very different and unusual. But at the core of it is the Frankenstein monster who is looking for a friend or a mate. And that made you empathize with that character. And that film is a remarkable movie. And I realized that that's what I wanted to do with Adam, is give him a search for a friend. I have actually a scene in the book in which what he does when he's alone, because he can reach out to every computer on the face of the earth, and he can tap into anything. What he does when he is alone is he watches the movie Pinocchio over and over again,
Just wants to be a
because
real boy, right?
he wants to be a real boy. You're absolutely on the money. I think you got my book before you were reading it. You absolutely are tuned into the same thing. That's what I tried to do here, is to create a character that had a certain kind of empathy and a certain kind of human desire that you can feel and sense, so that he became a lot more. And I have him having these dialogues with one of the people who came on as a VIP that came on comes on the plane. And I enjoy this a lot. It's the lady president, and it's Madam President, and she's on the plane. And now when he takes control of the plane, he talks to her. He still treats her with respect, and he talks to her as the president. And he gets into and she realizes that maybe she needs to keep him busy, keep him talking. She introduces him to, she plays chess because she knows that all computers, at the beginning learn how to play chess. So she says, "Well, why don't we play a game?" So I have her playing chess with Adam and also talking to him at the same time. And at one point, if I can tell you a little brief moment about a sense of the book, and give you a sense of the idea, is that what Adam says to her is, when she asks him about what his plans are and what he wants to do, he says his dream is, "I want to protect America because I am the greatest repository of intelligence and information on the face of the earth. All information is available at my fingertips in seconds. In nanoseconds. Therefore, I can protect this country like nobody else ever could. And I want to bring along a peace and stability and a world of prosperity and freedom." And she says, "Well, what do the people do? And what about other people? You have to have people doing certain things." And he says, "I will stay above the fray of politics." And that's his attitude. "I'll stay above the fray of politics, and I will be like a ruler. So, but I have no responsibility, or I don't owe anything to anybody. And I would make you like the president now. I would make you like prime minister, so that you can guide everything. But ultimately, you'll all report to me because I will do something that's best for everybody." And she said, "So you make those decisions?" And he says, "Yes." And she says, "Well, then you're kind of a king. You're kind of a monarchy. It's not a republic or a democracy." And he says, "Well, democracy is just a word. I'm going to give people prosperity and freedom and hope, but I will have the decisions." And she says, "And how long will this go on?" And he says, "As long as I thrive." And she basically says to him, "But you're eternal. You don't die. You'll be there forever." And he said, therefore, that's good for this nation, for America. I will provide all of those elements of peace and freedom forever. And she says, and you think it's just the difference between us is a word, and the word is democracy. And he said, yes, it is not, monarchy is nothing to be afraid of. And she said, well, in essence, she says to him, there's a difference. In a monarchy, when the leader makes some bad decisions, he changes the people. In a democracy, when the leader makes some bad decisions, the people change him. And that's the difference between democracy and a monarchy. So, and I love the idea of that argument. When Kirkus Reviews looked at the book and they reviewed it, they said that not only is it a terrific, nonstop thriller, but it deals with these issues that we have to face now because artificial intelligence represents maybe the terminator of tomorrow. It's that world where what's going to be the dominant civilization, part of our civilization? Is it going to be artificial intelligence and all it can do? Or is it going to be human beings? Is mankind at risk at this moment? Not today, but in 25 years from now? I don't, that's the question, and that's the kind of answers I'm trying to give in Black Sun.
Well, you got me itching to read it here because in my day job for more than 30 years, I've been a high school history and government teacher. And boy, this plays right into that.
Well, I think, look, we're all dealing in a moment in our time when we are analyzing everything. We are in a situation where we're looking at what our world is going to be, how our world is going to shape up in the future. And I think artificial intelligence plays a big part in that. I have my Adam in this book. He can tap into everything. And one of my favorite scenes in the book is when he's able to hack into, which nobody can do with all the firewalls. He actually breaks into the nuclear football and he gets all the codes and he says, you either do what I say or I will launch every missile in this country. And that will be it. And so, and no matter what happens, I will survive. And so he represents the ultimate threat. And that's what I think it is what makes Black Sun a kind of a thrill ride. But also makes you ask yourself some very important questions and questions that we have to look at our moment in history and the things that we deal with right now. So I think it's both timely, evocative, and a lot of fun.
Well, I can't wait to read it. Black Sun, the new book from Robert Boris. Hey, I don't want to tie up for too long, but I've got a couple questions about.
I'm at your disposal, Rich.
Well,
Can I just say one thing? Can I
yeah,
just one little thing? And
please
then
do.
you can ask any question you want about the 70s, about movies in the 70s, about actors that I knew. And it's really, I find that all very interesting. And one of the things that I want to do now is I have a website where I want to help writers in the future. I want to give back what I've learned after 50 years. And so I want to give some of that experience back to people. So I'm invite them to my website, but what I was going to say to you was, when I heard your name, I'm sure you and I grew up with the same thing. You grew up with a lot of you've heard every possible teasing and joke about your name, and I would grow up as are you Boris Karloff? I grew up with the same thing. So I don't know whether you and I have 6 degrees of separation,
I still, to this
but that.
day, once a year at least, go through an airport and somebody says, "Oh, Richard Kimball," and I always say, "My wife is fine. I have not seen the one-armed man." I got it twice.
Well,
I got it as a kid with the David Janssen series, and then Harrison Ford comes along when I'm a grown-up, and bam, it's back.
I worked with Janssen twice,
Yes, that's right.
I adored the guy, and so when I first heard that I was going to do work with you, which I was thrilled about, I thought of course I flashed on Rich, on David. And I made a movie with him called, two movies called Birds of Prey. And he was a helicopter pilot. And he was the warmest, friendliest, most terrific guy. And he really enjoyed this character of an old World War II pilot, fighter pilot, who was now driving a traffic watch helicopter in Salt Lake. And so, but what I thought was fascinating, or what I liked, I don't know, it's not fascinating, but it was interesting. He said, I had never asked to keep anything from most of the movies that I've done, but this jacket, this leather, old, beat up, wardrobe found a really old kind of World War II leather jacket that probably somebody wore during the war. And it was just old, beat up, but it just fit Jansen perfectly. And he said, that's the only thing I've ever wanted to keep. And he wore it on several of his shows. Harry O, he wore it a bunch of times, and he kept it. And I always thought that was fascinating, that he felt so comfortable as this old World War II pilot, that when I knew that I was going to be working with you, I thought you might enjoy that story, and especially about the fact that the guy was just, he was a sentimentalist at heart, and he had a strong feeling about that jacket, and he kept it.
Love that. We got some stories about him from a woman who was in a relationship with him for many years, the songwriter Carol Connors.
Oh, of course. He was, look, first of all, he was gorgeous. Second of all, I enjoy, there wasn't anything that he did that I didn't want to watch.
Yeah, he was
He
great.
was just compelling. So you had some questions for
Well,
me,
I
please.
wanted to ask you because I had read somewhere in an interview not too long ago that you were thinking about doing another Marilyn Monroe project. You did the wonderful film Marilyn and Me, and I had heard that you would, over the years, amassed quite a bit of information about her life.
If I may digress for a bit, but yes, when I did Blood Feud and worked on the Kennedy administration, I went to Washington to do research. That's what I love about my job, is the idea of I get a bit of history or a story that I want to know more about, and then I spend time researching it and digging it out. I love doing that. And I want to give people, I want them to share the same visceral response to history that I have. So I was in Washington and I was talking to people who knew Kennedy. And then I got a chance. I think I'm probably the only one alive right now who can say, maybe, that could be facetious on my part, but I'm the only one who can say that I met Bobby Hatt in the basement of the Justice Department. He had a room that he called the Get Hoffa Squad. And it was a bunch of FBI agents and forensic accountants who worked with no other job but getting Jimmy Hoffa at the Teamsters. And I'm probably the only person that met every one of them who worked in the Get Hoffa Squad. I got to know them, the FBI agents, Walter Sheridan, the forensic accountants, Carmen Bolino, all the others. I got to know them. And they, as they got comfortable with me, they began to share stories. And amongst them were stories about Bobby, because Walter Sheridan and most of them, and through his later years, they stayed with the Kennedy family. They stayed with Bobby until he ran for, was running for president. They moved on to Ted Kennedy. So they knew the family really well. So they shared honest truths and feelings with me. And so I began to learn a lot about Marilyn and Bobby and the Kennedy family from them, things that most people don't know. And it came from a bunch of FBI agents and people who worked with Bobby every single day for years. And so I wanted to tell a story. So I first did research on a story, a script that I wrote called The Night That Marilyn Died, because there were a lot of conspiracies and mysteries as to her life and as to what happened at the end. And I'm thinking about that as my follow-up novel to Black Sun. I've been thinking about that. I've also been thinking about another book on Bobby Kennedy as a follow-up novel. The other thing I came across, which I think is really fascinating, and it's a script that I really love deeply and want to tell, is the story of the Cal Neva Lodge. Cal Neva was a lodge on the border between California and Nevada. And Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack took it over. They became the owners of the Cal Neva Lodge, and it became the greatest hotspot in in the world in those couple of years in the 60s. So it was Frank and Dean and Sammy and Peter Lawford and Joey Bishop was there. And they were joint owners of Calneva. And the border of between the two states went right in the middle of the casino. So if the cops were coming over, they actually moved all the casinos over to the Nevada side and over the tables. And then when the cops left, they put the tables back into the California side.
Love it. Love it.
But they had this remarkable place. But Marilyn was a dear friend, and Frank almost felt like a older brother or very close to her. And so he used to have her come over all the time, especially when she was in trouble. And on the last weekend of her life, and this is all true, she came to Calneva because she was finished with Jack. This is shortly after, happy birthday, Mr. President. And the world for her basically blew up, and Jack said, we can't talk anymore. And Bobby talked to her. She was all brokenhearted. She threatened to reveal the relationship she had with Jack. And so there was, everybody was trying to tell her, Marilyn, don't do that. Don't do that. That's the wrong thing to do. And so she, Frank said, why don't you come here and stay at Calneva? And he put her in a private bungalow that nobody knew about. And he kept her there. And what happened on that weekend, it was maybe the most explosive weekend in the history of Hollywood. That what happened was first, Joe DiMaggio, who was her husband, basically couldn't find her, and he knew where she was. And he came up to Calneva on that weekend saying he wanted to see Marilyn. They said, she's not here. He went back to his car, he took out a baseball bat, and he came into the lobby and he started to wreck the lobby. Frank Sinatra came out, Dean Martin came out, and they all calmed him down. They said, she isn't here. And finally, Joe was taken, gave it up and left. But there was that explosion. The second explosion was the co-owner of, and Dean and Sam and the others didn't know it, but the real co-owner of Calneva were Sam Giancana and the mob. So it was a co-owned operation. Basically, the front guy was Frank Sinatra because Giancana, being a gangster, could not get a gaming license.
Right.
So now, not wanting the world to be upset, besides which, as the story has it, Giancana's girlfriend was having a relationship with Jack. And so he
Judith Exner, right?
Pardon me?
Was it Judith Exner, I think, if I remember right.
Yes, correct. Very good. So he didn't want anything to disturb that. So on that same weekend, when Joe DiMaggio explodes, who goes to see Marilyn in her private secret bungalow is Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana. And they treat her like, my dear, we care about you. We like you very much, but this is unwise, and anything you do to upset the apple cart is not in your best interests. And so it was, of all the showdowns, it became so serious that Bobby Kennedy, who was staying in San Diego, secretly got into a helicopter and he flew to Peter Lawford's house on Malibu and then drove secretly to Calneva and went to see Marilyn and try to talk her out of any press conferences or anything else. So you had all these forces coming together on this one weekend, a week before she died, one single week before she died. And they tried to talk to her, and ultimately she canceled her press conference. She went back to her house. She stayed there at her house and where she lived. And a week later, she was dead. Interestingly enough, there was a plaque on the house where she lived that she bought just a year before. And the plaque on it said, I think it was Cursum Delficio. I think that's the, I'm not positive that that's the Spanish. But Cesar Romero finally told her what it meant, and that's one of the reasons she bought the house. And the house had this brass plaque that said, Journey's End.
Wow.
First in Pulp Fiction, Journey's End. So I thought, you know, that story of Cal Neva, and after all of those explosions and her death, and then there was a big investigation. Basically members of the Rat Pack, they gave up their ownership, and even though Frank stayed with the hotel, they wanted no part of it. They didn't want any part of being part of with anything connected to possible organized crime. So they quit. And literally about, I would say, I think a month later, Cal Neva shut its doors because the gaming license was taken away from Frank Sinatra, so he couldn't operate it as a gaming casino anymore. So it closed its doors. So I was decided to write this book and this screenplay called Cal Neva, which is about the last weekend before Marilyn died. And it was to me the day that Hollywood died, because all the glamour and all of that, the way of looking at that world where everybody used to come, it disappeared. So yes, you're right. I have been thinking about either doing a novel on the night Marilyn died, or doing Cal Neva, which has all these wonderful characters who stayed there at this, you know, the ultimate watering hole of the 1960s.
Man, I could talk with you all day. So many great and fascinating stories. Robert, it's been such a treat. The book Black Sun, published by Outskirts Press. I can't wait to read it. I hope we can get you back on again to talk with us. This has been great.
I would love to. I enjoy talking with you very much. You're an incredible historian. Your command of the facts is remarkable. And if it's okay, I would just like to mention, can I say the name of my website? Because I
Oh,
want to
please
help
do.
writers.
Yes, absolutely.
It's called HollywoodMedia.com. Or it's also been listed as Hollywoodland, because that was the sign on top of the mountain. The original sign was Hollywoodland.
Right.
So I've had both. I own both names. So it's HollywoodlandMedia.com or HollywoodMedia.com, and I want to have I have a site where I talk about the books we're going to do. I offer a lot of services and help for writers who want to improve and learn their skills. And I feel that that's something I can help with. And I would love to have people come visit and see what we can provide. And I want people to read Black Sun because I think it is the story of our times. We are going through a change now, and the story of how man copes with artificial intelligence and all the miracles it can provide, but also the dangers it can present.
Well, I can't wait to read it. The next time we talk, I will have read the book and we can chat more about that and some more great stories. Robert, man, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I feel it's been a privilege to talk to you.